Further discussion on the motion of the senator from Boone? Seeing none, Senator, you're recognized to close.
Thank you, Mr. President. And again, the language that we're removing is not required for the fix. It's language that was put in to address some of the things in the Miller case from the U.S. Supreme Court, which prosecutors are going to address anyway when they build the record in their case. Prosecutors do it all the time. So it's unnecessary. It will cause a whole lot more problems on appeal if we leave it in than if we take it out. With that, I close.
You've heard the motion of the senator from Boone. All those of the opinion that motion shall prevail say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no.
No.
The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. You have adopted the amendment. You're back on the motion of the senator from Green. Senator from the 4th, what reason do you rise?
Senator from Green.
Senator from Green. Senator from Green. Senator from the 4th would like to inquire of you. You yield. Proceed, Senator.
Thank you, Senator.
Good evening.
Good evening. I've been inundated with paperwork about your bill here. I've got more stories than I care to read, really, to be honest with you. But I was going through all the papers, and I came across the committee minutes. This has been a contentious bill for 2 years now.
Well, and it's, you know, part of the challenge is there's a real diversity of opinion on what we should do.
Yeah, and I would agree with that, but...
there's an agreement.
Yeah, we finally have an agreement on this bill. But you only had one witness testify in favor of it, and three testify against it. So the only witness testify in favor was the Missouri Association of Prosecuting Attorneys. And
I will say we did not put out a request for testimony.
Pardon me?
I said I should mention that we did not put out a request for testimony.
Okay. But anybody, I mean, for as contentious of a bill, you would have think people would want to chime in on this, right? Do you think people just don't know? People don't know how to testify on it?
I think that's probably some of it. I can tell you that when the bill last year, which didn't have the tier, it just was the straight 50, just a random poll, at least in my district, which is pretty half and half, partisan-wise, it was like 75 or 80% in favor of doing the 50 years or life.
All right.
Just a random poll. And that's for first-degree murder, which these are the most egregious, the most heinous of crimes. I've passed out to members a couple of examples, 3 or 4 pages of examples of the kinds of crimes we're talking about. Mind you,
I can agree with you more about this.
I know
they're egregious crimes. That's why we're still going to sentence them to life without parole.
Well, but remember that even if they're charged with first-degree murder, the jury can come back and say, that's a little much. We're only going to convict them of second-degree murder, which takes it to 10 to 30 years or life. Or they can do third, which is voluntary and involuntary manslaughter. So they still have that whole range. We're not taking that away. These are just the ones that are convicted of first-degree murder.
Right. I understand that. And yeah. we still...
I know you do.
We still allow them to be sentenced to life without parole.
Yes.
The problem that we're... The brunt of 2 years of discussion has been, okay, what's plan B on this? And, you know, what's the alternative?
Last year, plan B was to see what the court said.
Yeah.
And the court said, legislature, this is your job. You
right.
do it.
Right.
Which I think was the right thing for them to do.
I don't blame the court. All right, so we had the prosecuting attorneys are the only ones that voted in favor of it.
Well, they were the only ones that testified.
Testified in favor of it.
Yes. I did not ask anyone to testify.
But the Missouri Catholic Conference, the Missouri Association of Social Welfare, and the Missouri Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys testified against it.
And, you know, I don't remember if those groups all testified against it last year, but I will say that I noticed that this year there was a trend that among those that testified against it, they all kind of seemed to say, well, we want to get rid of the ability of a juvenile to be convicted of first-degree murder. which I think is just terrible.
And
you've got to have those tools out there.
Yep, you and I, we're not even going to debate that tonight. That's not on the table. I mean, I was a little bit taken aback at how 2 years of a contentious bill, we only had four witnesses.
Well, I think that a lot of folks expected us to kind of come to a consensus last year because we have all these people out there. We have a number of juveniles who've been convicted by juries, by their peers, citizens in their community who have said, your crime is so heinous that it is first-degree murder, which means you should spend more than 30 years in prison because that would be the height of second-degree murder conviction. But yet there is nothing there that they can be sentenced with. So they're convicted and waiting for a sentence.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Further discussion on Senate Bill 790. Senator from Phelps.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I have an amendment, and it is being printed and hopefully distributed pretty quickly, so I won't close.
Please send your amendment forward.
I will do, and I move for its adoption.
It is being distributed. Are you requesting a waiver of the reading?
Yes, and it will be distributed.
Hearing no objection to the waiver of the reading, it shall be waived. You will not be recognized to close until such time it has been distributed. Senator, please explain your amendment.
What this amendment does, it's actually Senate Bill 945. It's the Timely Justice Act, and it provides cases where a child's been kidnapped and then murdered, and then if we go on to the court process and the defendant is found of first-degree murder and sentenced to death, it does not take any of the appeals process away. It just speeds up and doesn't allow them to sit there. Some of the last folks that's been on death row have been sitting there for 20, 25 years, and some of their victims did not get the opportunity to live that long on earth. So I talked about it a little bit earlier in the session, and we filed the bill, and it's in committee, and I thought this was a good time to talk about this situation a little bit, and it fits on this bill very well. So, any questions on the amendment? I'll be glad to try to answer them.
Senator from Phelps has moved for the adoption of Senate Amendment Number 3. Senator from Green.
Mr. President, with all respect to Senator Phelps from Phelps, I do rise to reluctantly raise a point of order.
State your point of order.
President, Senate Bill 790 is relating to first-degree murder. Senate Bill 945, which is the underlying bill which forms the amendment, relates to the death penalty, and it deals with criminal procedures, specifically execution procedures. And I would raise the point of order on that basis.
The point of order shall be referred to the President pro tem. Does any senator desire to be heard on that point of order? Senator from Phelps.
I disagree. I think it does fit very well. We checked that out pretty thoroughly before we filed the amendment. And therefore, I would request a ruling in favor of allowing the amendment to go on.
Any further discussion on the point of order, Senator from the 10th, for what reason do you rise?
To speak in favor of the point of order.
Proceed, Senator.
Mr. President, this amendment goes beyond the scope and is not germane to the underlying bill, which has to do with first-degree murder as it relates to juvenile offenders.
Point of order shall be referred to the pro tem. Senator for the 23rd.
Mr. President, I'd like to take that point of order under advisement.
Shall be taken under advisement. The bill will be placed on the informal calendar. Senator from Newton.
President, without objection, the Senate will go to business of Senate bills perfection. I'd ask you to call the calendar.
Senate bills for perfection. Senate Bill 501. Senator from the 4th.
Mr. President, I move that Senate Bill number 501 be taken up for perfection.
You've heard the motion of the Senator from the 4th. All those with opinion that motion shall prevail, say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The bill is before the body. Senator from the 4th.
Mr. President, this is a pretty simple bill. It's one paragraph long. It states that a trustee's engagement of an attorney is protected by the attorney-client privilege. There's been an issue that needed some clarity. Sometimes the courts have interpreted that the attorney owes a duty to the beneficiaries. This bill just states no. When the trustee hires the attorney, the confidential relationship exists, and they're protected by the attorney-client privilege. So with that, I'll answer any questions.
The senator from the 4th has renewed his motion on Senate Bill 501. Does any senator desire to be heard on that motion? Senator from Boone? Senator from Boone, for what reason are you seeking recognition?
The bill handler.
Senator from the 4th, do you yield?
I do.
Proceed, Senator.
I'm sorry, I just caught the tail. Tell me what this does again.
When a trustee hires an attorney.
Right. So you've got a trust.
We have a trust.
You got the trustee who's managing the trust.
That's correct.
And you've got at least one beneficiary. Let's say it's just a discretionary trust. It's for the benefit of the beneficiary. But it's the discretion of the trustee. It doesn't matter, I guess, in your bill.
Right. It's the discretion of the trustee.
Okay. Yeah. So what happens?
So the trustee goes and has an issue.
Uh-huh.
Whatever issue it is. He feels it's in the best interest of the trust to hire an attorney.
Okay.
He has communications with that attorney. This bill says those communications are offered the attorney-client privilege between the trustee and the attorney, and the beneficiaries don't have access to those.
So what are you going to do when a beneficiary basically says that the trustee is misappropriating funds on attorney's fees?
Well, he's going to have to prove that, and, you know, I guess...
Let's say the beneficiary says, okay, I got a trust that's got some assets and it generates $5,000 a month, and I get, as the beneficiary, the trustee gives me $5,000 a month, and all of a sudden he hires a lawyer and pays the lawyer $2,000 a month, and now I'm only getting $3,000 a month. I think that that's ridiculous. I don't know what he's paying a lawyer $2,000 a month for on this trust, but I can't find out. What do we do in that situation?
Well, he's going to sue the trustee, yeah. And then the trustee's going to have to prove that those charges are justified.
All right. Well, so your bill doesn't address that. It just addresses the privilege portion of it?
It just addresses the privilege.
Is there anything in there about basically waiver of the privilege?
No.
When there's a claim or allegation of malfeasance on the trustee or lack of fiduciary responsibility on the part of the trustee?
Nope. It's a pretty simple bill.
What do we do now? I mean, because now...
Well, that's why we're doing it. Because some courts have it interpreted.
Right. Because every circumstance that I've seen like that, beneficiaries have been entitled... When they ask for it, they get it. I personally haven't seen a situation where the trustee says, I don't want to show that to you.
Well...
But they certainly could exist.
They're still entitled to the accounting. This doesn't affect the accounting of the trust.
Right, but all they're going to get is, I paid an attorney, you know, $2,000 last month out of the you know, what you would have gotten, basically, or the res or whatever you
have. I paid them more than that, probably.
Yeah.
But, no, I mean, yeah, if they're going to make an allegation of malfeasance or something, yeah, they're going to have to prove that.
All right, I'm trying to think of a circumstance of when the trustee would want to basically shield the content of the communication with the attorney from the beneficiary.
Well, now the trustee still has a duty to the beneficiaries, right? He still has a duty to the trust.
A fiduciary duty, so it's going to be
exactly.
In terms of dollars and asset management of, you know, handling the trust.
I'm sorry?
It's a fiduciary responsibility for the beneficiary, which basically means you have to appropriately manage the assets or the capital in the trust.
That's correct. That's
your duty to the beneficiary.
Right. Right. So, I mean, if he has, let's say, conflicting let's say he has 35 different beneficiaries.
Right.
If they have competing interests, the trustee and the attorney are going to get pulled in. Could conceivably be pulled in a number of different directions. All this is doing is saying the communication.
I know, but they can still get that. It's just I'm trying to think of the circumstances of where they wouldn't want those 35 beneficiaries to see the communications, and like what when that circumstance would arise. Because normally, if you're the trustee and you've got competing beneficiaries,
I mean,
you get a legal opinion and you go to them and you go, I got a legal opinion. Here's what it is. And right. This is what I'm going to do now because this is what the attorney said the options are. I'm just trying to think of a circumstance where you don't want to tell the beneficiaries that. You don't want to disclose to them what the legal opinion is.
Well, I mean, and if that could be the case, the trustee can waive the privilege, right?
I know, but beneficiaries aren't going to be too happy with it.
Well, sure. He can waive it and give them all the information that they want, right?
Right, but when the beneficiary, who the trust exists for their benefit, they see the bill for attorney's fees and they call the trustee and they say, hey, why did you hire a lawyer? And the trustee says, I'm not going to tell you that. And you say, well, wait a minute. This is my trust. I'm the beneficiary.
Well,
and the trustee says, well, sorry, I spent that money on a lawyer and I'm going to spend a whole lot more and I'm not going to tell you what it's on. I'm just...
Right, right.
Having dealt with beneficiaries and trustees and a whole lot of trust, I just...
Right.
This is not going to make the beneficiaries happy.
They probably aren't going to be as happy come September the 1st.
It will make life easier for trustees.
It will make life easier for trustees, that's
right.
Correct. And attorneys. Because there won't be any uncertainty anymore. It will be... People will
know, but I've just never been in a circumstance where the trustee doesn't just tell the beneficiaries, you know, here's what the opinion is. I asked the lawyer to tell me, give me an opinion on this, and the lawyer gave me an opinion, here it is.
Well, and again, the reason for the bill is all we're doing is saying, you know, the trustee, there have been interpretations where...
Right, but beneficiaries, especially on discretionary trusts, already complain that trustees don't tell them enough. And now yeah. We're going to pass a bill that says on legal opinions, trustees don't have to tell the beneficiaries anything. And absent some malfeasance, the beneficiary's got no right to find out what that. I see a whole lot of issues there. And the thing is, I think the reason you kind of get cases is because courts kind of weigh this and look and say, you know, what's appropriate, what's not, if it comes up. But it seems unfair to beneficiaries of trusts to basically give the trustee that level of absolute ability to not disclose what the content of was with communications with an attorney that they paid for out of the trust.
You know, off the top of my head, I can't think of a...
Yeah, I can't either. And that's, I mean, maybe if, like, there was some fact pattern, you'd be like, oh, okay, I get that. But all it is trustees are annoyed generally by beneficiaries and they don't want to give them any information, and this just gives them the ability to not.
Well, you know, again, we talked about there's still the fiduciary responsibility to the beneficiaries.
Right, but it's going to get a whole lot harder now for a beneficiary to raise a claim that they violated their fiduciary duty or committed malfeasance if they don't even know what the content of the communication is.
Yeah, so I mean, let's flip that over on its head a little bit. Are we going to say, all right, Mr. Trustee, we're going to have you do this, but if you ever consult the services of an attorney, all those communications are out there for everybody if they request them. I mean, we're going to start having a hard time.
Yeah, but we're not saying that either. If we don't do this, we're just going to leave it the way it is, which seems to be working.
Which people don't know. No, and that's the reason we're doing it, because it's going both ways.
So rather than, I mean, if this is really the road you want to go down, rather than saying that, you know, it's just carte blanche, the trustee has the discretion, why not define those circumstances when a trustee doesn't have to?
So, I'm sorry.
In other words, saying trustee never has to disclose the communications with an attorney. Why not say under the circumstances that you're trying to get to, under those circumstances they don't have to disclose it?
I don't know how to word that off the top of my head.
Why not? Because we can't come up with a circumstance of when the trustee would ever not want to tell the beneficiary or disclose to them what the content of the legal advice was.
Well, you know, I just got a handy little note here. I love these things.
Well, hopefully it's from somebody who knows.
Without the privilege, trustees might be inclined to forsake legal advice, thus adversely affecting the trust. As disappointed beneficiaries could later pore over the attorney-client communications.
Why would that ever discourage a trustee from getting legal advice?
No, in second-guessing the trustee's actions.
Yeah, but if you're a trustee and you're faced with a legal issue, it's perfect, you know, as long as it's not something completely absurd, I mean, it's perfectly reasonable for you within your statutory duties as a trustee under the general statute of the state of Missouri to get a legal opinion. So I still don't understand why you'd need to shield that from the beneficiary.
Well, I'm trying to think of a good fact pattern for you to do.
It just seems like maybe we're just doing this for trustees because it makes their life easier. But, you know, it's not always easy being a trustee because...
It's not. I agree. And, again, the bill's intent is to try and make life a little bit easier on a trustee so they can speak candidly with their attorney, right? That's the whole attorney-client privilege. That's the whole reason for it, right? So...
I know, but you have the beneficiaries who are an interested party in that whole trust, in the whole process. And so even though you have a trustee whose judgment is basically, you're replacing the beneficiary's judgment with the trustee's judgment. That's really what you're doing.
No, we're not.
Well, in a discretionary trust, that's absolutely what you're doing. That's why you set up a trust.
Right. Well, no, but the beneficiaries don't have any decision-making authority there, right?
No. Oh, well, I know. That's why you do the trust.
The trust. That's why you put a guy in charge of it.
Right.
That's why we want him to make sure he does it right. That's why...
Right, but just because you're giving that judgment to the trustee doesn't mean that you should shield a beneficiary from the legal... I don't...
From the legal advice that that the trustee obtains?
Yes.
I don't see a problem with that.
I do, though, from the perspective of beneficiaries, not from trustees. I mean, if you were a trustee for a trust, you would want this. Because it gives you more ability to control the information about the trust that goes to the beneficiary. If you're a beneficiary of a trust, you want to know everything about what's going on with that trust.
And you do get that. You do get an accounting.
So when the trustee says, well, I had to hire a lawyer to look at a legal opinion for the trust, but I'm not going to tell you what we discussed, that's a huge red flag for a beneficiary.
You know?
And right now, arguably, they can get it.
And right now what?
Arguably right now they can get those communications.
Sometimes they can, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I just don't know that we should completely close the door on that. Which is why I said maybe if there were certain circumstances, having to do with, whether or not something, the legality of something the beneficiary is doing or something like that, maybe that could be closed. But
I'd be more than happy to work with you on it.
I just don't know what it would be. I mean, I just personally believe in most circumstances of a trust, the trustee should be very candid with the beneficiary. And under our current law, they don't have to be that candid, even though I think they should be. They still have to manage it appropriately, but they don't have to be that candid with the beneficiary. What we're going to do, though, is take away a little bit more information that the beneficiary gets.
All right.
So, I don't know if there's a fix for it. It just seems a little problematic.
All right.
So,
I think I'll lay it over. I'll come back to you with it.
You know, and maybe, I mean, has the bar worked on this or anything?
Yeah, this came out of Trust and Probate Committee.
I mean, I'd be curious to know then what the circumstance is from the trust section of the bar, what they're trying to do other than just make life easier for trustees.
All right.
Which may be good for trustees, but not good for beneficiary.
All right.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Mr. President, go ahead.
Senator from the 4th.
Okay. I'm going to lay it over. Mr. President, would you please put this bill on the informal calendar?
Shall be placed on the informal calendar. Senator from 32nd. Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Senator from Newton. Thank you, Mr. President. Would you please refer the gubernatorial appointments to the Gubernatorial Appointments Committee, number one.
They shall be referred.
I have a revised hearing schedule that I am going to send forward, and I would ask that it be printed in the journal.
It shall be printed.
Thank you.
Assuming you did not change the time for commerce. Senator from Newton.
Without objection, the Senate will go to business of Senate Bill Perfection Formal Calendar. I actually recognize the Senator from Lewis on Bill 745.
Informal calendar, Senator from Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. President. I ask that Senate Bill number 745 be brought from the informal calendar and be placed before the body.
You've heard the motion of the Senator from Lewis. All those opinion that motion shall prevail, say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The bill is before the body.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that substitute for Senate Bill number 745 be declared perfected and order printed. And this was a bill that we had up just a while ago, and I believe the senator from the 15th and I had a little discussion, and I believe that probably he has an amendment, if I can get his attention on this amendment. But that's what this bill does. It's a fix, really, for Senate Bill 75 we passed last year.
Senator from Lewis has moved for the adoption of the Senate substitute. Does any senator desire to be heard? Senator from the 15th.
President, I have an amendment.
Please send your amendment forward. Has it been distributed?
It has been distributed, Mr. President. I ask for a waiver of the reading.
Hearing no objection to the waiver of the reading, it shall be granted.
Thank you, Mr. President. This amendment would address the issue that I brought up to the senator from Lewis as to the potential of this bill requiring counties to appropriate money, which is a place that I don't really want to go to, but would keep intact, I think, his intent, which is to make sure that the money for the inmate security fund that we give counties is actually used for that purpose. So this would eliminate any language that would cause confusion over what we're requiring counties to do, but make sure that the sheriffs have the assurance that that money is going to be used for prisons or for the inmate prisoner fund. And with that, Mr. President, I move for its adoption.
Senator from the 15th has moved for the adoption of Senate Amendment Number 3. Does any senator desire to be heard on that motion? Seeing none, Senator, you recognize to close.
I close.
Senator from 15th has renewed his motion for the adoption of Amendment Number 3. All those of the opinion that motion shall prevail will say aye. To the contrary, will say no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The motion carries. We're back to the adoption of the Senate substitute by the senator from Lewis. Does any senator desire to be heard on that motion? Seeing none, Senator from Lewis, you recognize to close.
I close.
Senator from Lewis has renewed his motion for the adoption of the Senate substitute. All those of the opinion that motion shall prevail will say aye. To the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. You've adopted the Senate substitute. Senator from Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. President. I now move that Senate Bill Number 75 be declared perfected and order printed.
You've heard the motion of the senator from Lewis. Does any senator desire to be heard on that motion? Seeing none, Senator, you're recognized to close.
I close.
The senator has renewed his motion for the third reading of Senate substitute for Senate Bill 745. I'm sorry, the perfection motion for the Senate substitute for Senate Bill 745. All of the opinion that motion shall prevail, say aye. To the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. You have approved the motion. Senator from Newton.
Thank you, Mr. President. Objection. Senator will go to business of House Senate Bills for Perfection. I'd ask you to call the calendar.
Senate Bills for Perfection, SJR 34. Senator from Martin.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that SJR 34 be taken up off the formal calendar for perfection.
You heard the motion of the senator from Barton. All of the opinion that motion shall prevail, say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The bill is before the body. Senator from Barton.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move for the perfection and printing of Senate Joint Resolution 34. This is a proposed constitutional amendment. It's approved by the voters. It would require that all impeachments be tried by the Senate rather than before the Missouri Supreme Court. If the governor is tried, then the Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court would preside over the Senate, and no persons would be convicted without a two-thirds vote of all senators present. Mr. President, from 1820 until 1945, about 125 years, Missouri filed and prosecuted impeachments as they are pursued in the federal model in accordance with the founders' original design. The Missouri Constitution for that 125 years, Article 3 of the state Constitution, identified the Missouri House of Representatives as having the sole power of impeachment. All impeachments were tried in the Missouri Senate, requiring a two-thirds vote to convict. The one exception was in the event of the impeachment of the governor, in which case the presiding judge of the Supreme Court was to preside over the Senate, which made perfect sense because otherwise, it would be the lieutenant governor, which could either be prejudiced for or prejudiced against the impeachment of the governor. During that 125 years, there were seven cases of impeachment. That included two acquittals, two convictions resulting in removal from office, two cases of which I have not found an outcome, and one case where the charges were dropped. Six of those charges were against judges. One was a state treasurer. There's exhaustive information about both specific impeachments, impeachments in general, and the impeachments of practices of other states on each of the senators' desks that was distributed earlier. I'd point out that 45 other states follow the federal model. Four states follow variations of that federal model. Only one state, Nebraska, tries impeachments in the Supreme Court, and that's because they have a unicameral legislature, and they recognize that it would be inappropriate for the same body to file the charges and try those charges. The bottom line is no other state follows the model used by Missouri since 1945. Being unique is not the concern I have, Mr. President, but what does concern me is the clear violation that Missouri's current procedure presents to the important doctrine of checks and balances between the three constitutional branches of government. There is a simple solution to this violation of checks and balances. It's to return this portion of Missouri's Constitution to the original language. Senate Joint Resolution 34 simply puts such proposal before the voters of Missouri. With that, Mr. President, I have an amendment.
Please send your amendment forward. Has it been distributed?
It has been distributed. I would ask for a waiver of the reading.
Hearing no objection to the waiver of the reading, it shall be granted.
Thank you, Mr. President. The amendment is simply adding ballot language to the SJR.
Senator, I need you to move for the adoption of the amendment.
I move for the adoption of the amendment.
Senator from Barton has moved for the adoption of Senate Amendment Number 1. Does any senator desire to be heard on that motion? Seeing none, Senator, you're recognized to close.
I close and renew my motion.
Senator from Barton has renewed his motion for the adoption of Senate Amendment Number 1. All those opinion that motion shall prevail, say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. You have adopted Senate Amendment Number 1. Senator from Barton.
Thank you, Mr. President. I renew my for the perfection of Senate Joint Resolution 34, and I'd be glad to take questions.
Senator from Barton has moved for the adoption of Senate Joint Resolution Number 34. Does any senator desire to be heard on that? Senator from Green.
To inquire of the Senator from Barton.
Senator from Barton, you yield.
I do yield.
Thanks, Senator. I appreciate you taking my inquiry. I was not in the chamber when you started, and of course we talked about this in committee, and you gave us a good explanation in committee. You alluded to, I believe, some of the history behind this, but let's talk about what the process is right now for the various people who can be impeached.
Sure.
Because this is a pretty significant change we would send to the voters in the form of a constitutional amendment.
Well, actually, Senator, the significant change was the one done in 1945, but we can still review the way it's done now.
And why did they change it in 1945?
Why did they change it?
Yes.
It's believed, Senator, and I've reviewed the documentation and I haven't found it expressed there, but that it was the impeachment of State Treasurer Larry Brunk that brought about that change. There was a feeling that the Senate had not fulfilled their obligations, although this was the seventh impeachment, which none of the others were contested by the courts. and because of that concern, then during the Constitutional Convention, the proposal was brought up to move the trials to the Supreme Court. There was significant discussion there about why you needed jurists to do this, that it was a political process and didn't need jurists, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of that is available in the packets that I have had distributed onto your desk. And so you can read those comments and discussion for yourself.
Well, let's talk about it out here because I don't know that everyone's had a chance to read it. So this fellow who was the state treasurer was impeached.
Right.
And he, from your discussion, the discussion that you and I had, he had, if I'm remembering correctly, he had been a senator, correct?
That's right. He was a former senator.
So why did this move gain so much steam to take the trial out of the Senate?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by so much steam.
Well, why was the trial taken out of the Senate and moved to the Supreme Court from the discussion that you and I had?
You mean during the Constitutional Convention?
Yes.
It's felt that it was because of the Larry Brunk trial and the mishandling of that trial, and it was a bit of a slap on the hand to the Senate to say we're not going to let you guys try the impeachments anymore.
But I thought I recalled from the conversation that we had that there was a feeling out there among the citizenry that the individual who was tried by his former colleagues, and it was not really a trial that was on the up and up. They felt like he should have been convicted
and removed
like
the Senate,
from office.
Yeah, that's right. They felt like the Senate had yielded to the cronyism. And had, instead of convicting, there was a sense that Larry Brunk had clearly violated his oath and his duty by mishandling state money.
And what was the outcome of that case?
The Senate acquitted him.
So there was serious evidence. He was impeached by the House.
That's correct.
And then the Senate acquitted him, so he remained in office.
That's right.
And then in 1945, when the Constitutional Convention occurred, citizens said, this isn't right. They felt like he should have been convicted, and it was almost like cronyism,
those
so they
in the
moved
convention
into the court.
Did. And, you know, you would hope that they had some sense of where the people were. I can't find evidence that part of the public perception was discussed in the minutes of the convention. The subject was primarily, where should we try this? Why should it be exclusively jurists? That it has always been tried by many who were not jurists. The kind of things that you might expect to come along with this. And there was one attorney that stood up and contested that it was a violation of checks and balances.
To move it
to no avail.
To move it to the Supreme Court.
Yes.
Okay. So, and the reason that they felt like it was a violation of checks and balances was it had no place. They felt like it had no place in the courts, but should have been tried here because it was a impeachment being a political tool, if you
right.
will.
Right. Yeah. And there's, of course, they didn't have this then, but, you know, since then we have a Supreme Court case which validates that at the Supreme Court level, that the impeachment has no place. You have some in Federalist 65. There's also considerable commentary there, and I think that's also included in the package that was distributed, where it is discussed that this is a political process. It's not a criminal process. It really doesn't belong in the courts. It belongs in the checks and balances of our constitutional arrangement as a tool of the legislature, and violating that. And I think one of the things that kind of supports that is that all but one of those impeachments since 1820, prior to 1945, were of jurists. Only one was of a statewide official rather than of a judge.
So now, what was that number again? All but one.
Larry Brunk was the only non-judge that was impeached.
So all the other impeachments were
all judges.
Were all judges. It almost sounds like a tug of war between the branches.
That's kind of what it's supposed to be. That's what checks and balances are intended to be,
exactly.
Senator. That's exactly,
exactly.
Right.
So the way the Constitution is written now, there's different ways that impeachment can work, just going off of our conversations from earlier. If it's the governor, the Senate would elect seven eminent jurists.
Right.
This is current constitutional law.
That was one of the elements of debate, because there was an amendment proposed to take that instead of eminent jurists to eminent people. With the discussion being, you don't need jurists on an impeachment. It's a political process. It's not a criminal process, and therefore it shouldn't be jurists. That amendment did fail in the convention.
In the convention, okay. Now, if it's a judge, no, if it's the Supreme Court justice,
Supreme Court justice,
then it's also a trial it is a trial by seven eminent jurists elected by the Senate. Anyone else?
With the governor.
Pardon?
Yes, right.
The governor or the chief judge, right? Currently.
Currently, all officials of the state, judges of the Supreme Court, this is susceptible to impeachment. Sole power of impeachment still in the House. All impeachments will be tried before the Supreme Court except the governor
and the
or
chief
a
judge.
Member of the Supreme Court. And those two will be tried by this special commission of seven eminent jurists.
And that's current law or what you're...
That's current law. That was what was enacted
in 1945.
I was thinking
it was just the Supreme Court judge, but... Okay. So, you know what...
They reduced the threshold from two-thirds to five-sevenths.
Right.
Which makes sense in the Supreme Court, obviously.
What... you know what this really causes me to think about is... This whole debate about there's a lot of folks out there who, because of the federal government being out of control, and I certainly agree that they are, that the answer would be to give the state legislatures, more of a voice in Washington, which we certainly need, and do that by repealing the 17th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which said that the U.S. senators would be elected by the people.
of each state rather than the way they were selected prior to the 17th Amendment, which was that the state legislatures would send a, they would elect a U.S. senator to represent the state legislature.
That was to preserve the federalist system.
Exactly. And I've given that a lot of thought because it occurs to me that no matter what system you have, as long as it's human, you're going to have imperfections.
Right.
And the reason that they changed that form of that system of selecting the U.S. senator and adopting, not only adopting, but having the 17th Amendment ratified, was because there was rampant corruptions in the state legislatures, and people were going in and saying, well, I'll give you an example. The guy that was the copper guru in, was it Montana or Wyoming, who decided he wanted to be a U.S. senator. So he went to New York and bought a Senate seat. It smacks of just unbelievable corruption. Of course, I think people can still go to New York and buy a Senate seat.
You're right.
Just have to buy it through the media. So that's my point, is no matter what system we have, we're not going to make it, there's no way to avoid that.
Human element.
The opportunity for the violation of basic ethics, unless we have very ethical people. And I know we had a very good debate about this in committee. I think we need a robust debate about this on the floor before we send it out of the chamber and determine if we're going to put this on the ballot for the people to change this process that was put in place and ratified with the people in the Constitution in that 1945 convention because of corruption in state government. We may be trading one problem for another.
Senator, can I ask you a question, even though it's your inquiry?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've given this a lot of thought, and I supported your effort to get it out of committee and bring it to the floor so we could talk about it.
You have. And I guess the thing that I'm wondering, and I don't know if you have an opinion on this or not, but I'd love to know your opinion about how many of the people who voted on that entirely new Constitution knew that they were changing the impeachment process.
Well, I doubt they knew a lot about what was all the changes were,
right,
because it was an entire document, which leads me to something else. If the people of this
in
state...
In criminal code.
Exactly. If the people of this state can vote on an entirely new constitution, then I think that the governor can work his way through the criminal code.
That's right. Good point. Good point, Senator.
And, you know, I hope that there's some good ongoing discussions, but, you know, we have had a lot of input. We have addressed every single concern. You know, we have reduced the size of that criminal code bill by almost half. And I'm not one to beat up on the executive branch, but for crying out loud, if 197 people can go through and peruse the bill and determine if it's consistent with the values of the people that they are sent here to represent, and we expect 6 million people to live by the law, I would think that they can take a little bit of time to review the law. We're not even trying to make it go into effect for well over a year. So, if the people can vote on an entirely new constitution in 1945, then I think we can get folks in on the second floor to review a criminal code in 2014 with the advent of greater technology than they had back then. So let's get back to what we're talking about here. And my intent is not to hold this up. I just want to make sure that we are fully vetting what we're doing, what the history was, and what the ramifications would be. So let's talk about the impeachments that we've had, because I know there was an impeachment back in the late 80s or early 90s. It was a Secretary of State.
Right. There have been actually 10 impeachments in the history of Missouri, three of those since this change, seven of those before this change. 125 years following the federal model, about 68 years following the model which Missouri alone follows of the 50 states. The first one was in 1825, then you have one in 1843, one in 1859, one in 1867, another in 1867, good year for impeachments, 1867. Then in 1872, and then in 1931 was State Treasurer Larry Brunk.
But that was the last one before the 45 convention.
That's right. Then the next one was in 1962.
So 62, and then the most recent one was Secretary of State Judy Moriarty. In what year was that?
That was 94.
In 1994, and she was removed from office, right?
She was removed from office.
So the system worked. I don't know the facts of that case. As I recall, I think she modified a document as Secretary of State, and her son was running or something like that. The House impeached her. I think actually a representative from Springfield area handled the handled part of the case. And Representative Connie Weibel, who's now either is or was on the Public Service Commission, and or participated in it before the court. So it went through the Supreme Court.
Right.
They looked at the facts. She was removed from office. So that there's, to me, that's a case where it worked.
Right.
The
and if we're just simply,
worked.
Senator, going to count the number of cases where it worked, then we would definitely move it back to the Senate because we have far more cases where it worked in the Senate. We only have one where it worked in the Supreme Court.
Well, how are we judging whether it worked? Because they were removed from office or they tried it based on the facts and did...
Well, you have two that were removed from office, two that were acquitted, and you have two more that I frankly just haven't been able to find the results of. So I don't see any prior to 1945.
Prior
you have seven impeachments prior to 1945. You have one impeachment since. You have... Well, actually, you have two impeachments, you have one trial since,
okay.
Because the others resigned before trial.
So
you have 80% judges that were impeached.
So it's quite possible that we would wind up having more impeachments. And actually, there's two bills in the House right now dealing with impeachment.
I know of one. I didn't know the other one.
Representative Moon filed articles of impeachment against the governor.
Representative White has this proposal. In
well, I'm talking about articles to impeach someone right now.
Right. Now, these wouldn't play any part in that because this would be on the ballot in November. And
I understand. But this is a very hot-button issue right now. So if we change the process, it just comes into the conversation. There's Representative Moon's articles of impeachment dealt with the, I cannot recall what that one was. One of them had to do with the governor's executive order dealing with state income tax returns for married couples, specifically same-sex couples under federal law. If they were filing on their
right.
on their federal return, then regardless of the constitutional provision in Missouri, his order was to let them file as such in Missouri. I can't remember if his was on that. I know that Representative Marshall filed articles of impeachment. Actually, I think that's the one that was dealing with that. And I can't recall what Representative Moon... Oh, Representative Moon's was on his failure to appoint members to boards and commissions and so forth. And all the acting directors for a neglect of duty. So I stand corrected. I corrected myself. It's kind of weird. Okay. So if we move forward with this and we change the process, it very possibly, we could actually, let's say this passes, we put it on the ballot in November, one of those two representatives file those articles of impeachment again, we could be having a trial here in the Senate.
Say that again. If one of them filed,
if those were
passed out of the House, then it would be the Supreme Court that would try them because this wouldn't be enacted until after it went to the vote of the people.
Right. I understand. If we adopt this and it goes on the ballot in November and it's adopted, and they file their articles of impeachment again next year,
right,
we would be having a trial in this chamber.
That's right.
And you know what's interesting to me? I'm not necessarily concerned
that it's a legal trial. It's really a political trial.
Exactly.
A lot of people think that the legislature is full of attorneys, which is interesting to me because we only have five in this body.
Senator from Barton.
President, would you please lay this on the informal calendar?
Shall be placed on the informal calendar. Senator from Newton.
Without objection, Senator Gordon Bennis, a message to the House of Representatives. I ask the Secretary please read the message.
Please read the messages from the House.
Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed House Committee Substitute House Bill 1089, entitled An Act Relating to the Bring Jobs Home Act. Also, Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed House Committee Substitute House Bill 1204, entitled An Act Relating to Aerial Surveillance. Also, Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed House Bill 1055, entitled An Act Relating to the Missouri International Business Advertising Fund. Also, Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed House Committee Substitute House Bill 1090, entitled An Act Relating to State Employees. Also, Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed House Committee Substitute House Bill 1300, entitled An Act Relating to Fire Protection District Board Meetings. Also, Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed House Bill 1504, entitled An Act Relating to Tax Increment Financing. Also, Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed House Bill 1791, entitled An Act to Authorize the Conveyance of Certain State Properties. Also, Mr. President, I am instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed House Bill 1802, entitled An Act Relating to the Designation of a Memorial Highway, in which the concurrence of the Senate is respectfully requested. Respectfully submitted, Daniel Adam Crumless, Chief Clerk.
Senator from Newton.
Without objection, Senator Gore Business Report, Standing Committee, and I have a report.
Please send your report forward. Madam Secretary, please read the report.
Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill No. 623, begs leave to report. It has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Respectfully submitted, Senator Richard, Chairman.
Senator from Newton.
President, without objection, Senator Gorbez, for announcements.
Announcements. Announcements. Senator from Newton.
Mr. President, no further business coming from the body. I move the Senate stand adjourned under the rules.
You've heard the motion of the Senator from Newton. All those opinion that motion shall prevail, say aye. To the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The Senate shall stand adjourned under the rules.